Okay, there's something that I've talked about in the past in some measure, but never in the measure of what I want to discuss this evening, because this evening our discussion crosses a lot of boundary lines, etc., to where you see things that are not really always discernible. And it's something that, in a roundabout manner, something that I've been talking about for some time, but talking around it. And number one, when we receive spiritual, you can call it any type of spirituality, really. So when you receive any measure of spirituality, what happens is there's what is called the divine flow. And the divine flow is often seen and called Shefa. And the thing about Shefa is that Shefa never stops. It flows and it flows and it flows. And it has a mechanism where when it comes down, it basically assesses our place and position, and it tries not to overcompensate for the amount of light that we receive, and then it will return and it will go back up. And it basically is like this continuous cycle of looping that will allow the Shefa, or the divine spring or flow of energy, to come and then for us to receive it. But sometimes what we have a tendency to do is try to force it. I do. I want to force it. I want to get it as fast as I can, as much as I can, etc. When this is not always truly practical. Okay, and so there's a verse in 2 Corinthians that is sort of a little bit like the end verses of Romans chapter 8. And it basically ties together a little bit, where that when you see the connection between the two verses, you understand that there's a connection between not the two verses, but the last section of Romans chapter 8, which is verses 31 through 39. And this is 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 17. And it says, for our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. Okay, so what we're discussing and what we're talking about is the weight of glory. Now, I learned about this many, many years ago from C.S. Lewis. Those that may know of him or not, it doesn't matter, but I learned of it from him, and he has a little booklet on some of the lectures. But none of this data came from C.S. Lewis. This is not definitely not his genre, so we, you know, have to just take it as we see it from the spiritual side. And seeing it and understanding it from the spiritual side is a very complex issue. And you can, you know, try to do a little research on it, and you try, as you do it, if you really find the depth of the research, it's one of those deep canyons that there's so much data in it that it's one of those things that it really could be a full thesis for any type of doctoral degree. But nevertheless, the idea is weight of glory. And the weight of glory, when we just say it like that, most people really don't fully comprehend the idea that there is a weight of glory. But now, first of all, kibod is a word that actually has built into its definition this measure of weight. And so it's like the idea generally comes from like the high priest. When the high priest put on all of his garments, now he's weighted down with the vestments of his office. And then when he goes out, there's no question as to who he is and what his job is, etc. You know exactly who he is and what it is. Now, the same thing can be said for a lot of different things in the Bible, etc. But one of the figures, you know, to really just take into measure about this particular idea is Moshe. And when you stop to think about how much the weight of glory weighed on him as an individual and the pressure that he underwent in the process of receiving just the Torah. Now, understand this. The flow comes down, and anybody who knows a little bit about, say, water will understand that, you know, water flows by gravity, which is basically how the entire infrastructure of most water systems work. If they don't put it in a pump and pump it to a location, then what they do is they build what we call like a water tower. And then when you build a water tower, they pump the water into the top of the tower, into the top of the container, and then that water that is sitting in the top generates a certain amount of pressure. And the pressure that it creates will always flow back to the same level. So, you know, no matter if you had a system, Paris has a system here where I live, they have a system where the water, all of the water tanks are on the same exact level. And then all of the tanks are looped together around the town. But still, the closer you are to a water tower, the higher the pressure will be. And no matter how that function, it functions partially from resistance on the line and everything. But now the point that I'm taking here is imagine somewhere above us in a spiritual realm, there is a tower filled full of the divine essence, and that essence then can flow down to us. Now, in our system, it flows around, but when there's no draw on the water, then the water has to stop, of course. And that stops through a check valve of some sort, not necessarily a check valve, but some sort of a valving system in the process anyway, okay? So what happens is that when the Shefa, the divine light, comes down out of the spiritual realm into us, it has pressure. And as it comes into us, it puts pressure on us. It puts pressure on us to receive. And it wants not just to stop inside of your spiritual vessel. It wants to keep moving. Okay? So, in one sense, you should readily understand that the reasoning behind this is because once we receive the Shefa, the divine flow of abundance, then what happens is it's supposed to flow through us, flow out to others. But sometimes it doesn't have an opportunity immediately to flow out of us. And when it doesn't flow out of us, then that means you have to retain and contain the essence within yourself. This is in Hebrew a term called hashba'ah, which actually means bestowal. Okay, so from our side, it's receiving. From God's side, it's bestowal. He gives it to us, and we receive it. Then we receive it, and once we receive it, the whole idea is for us to get, you know, to receive it and then give it back out and not to hold on to it. If some people try to hold on to it, and there's a problem with that. Once you try to hold on to it and you don't give it out, it becomes stagnant, and it has a value where, you know, we will lose it is what will happen. Okay. So now what I want you to try to understand in this process is that once it comes into us and you have to retain it, even for a measure of time before you give it out, you have to retain it. Then the vessel that is we as the vessel have to hold on to that light for a period of time. Okay? So if you imagine yourself as some form of a vessel a cup, a container, whatever you want to imagine, then you understand that you have to retain the pressure or the weight of the divine presence coming down onto yourself, into yourself. Okay? And so if you could see yourself in a spiritual sense, basically, in one sense, one way of explaining it, not necessarily the only way, but is to look at yourself as more of like an outline form. You still have features that your personal features, but you look more translucent than you look like we do physically now. And, you know, it might be a thin line that shows, you know, our form or whatever it might be. But once we understand that the divine essence is flowing out of the upper spiritual realms, it's literally flowing all the way from the top where God himself is, Adonai is, and then it flows all the way down to us where we are. And then once it comes into us, we have to be able to retain that in some measure and hold it, and then like a reservoir of some sort. And then once we do that, then we have to let it out. Okay, we cannot hold on to it. And very seldom should we ever say that it really turns into an absolute overflow, at least for the sake of this particular conversation. So number one, what we're talking about is, yes, divine flow, but we're actually talking about the divine presence itself. Okay, and it coming and it coming down and resting upon us, and it putting the full weight of the glory of God on our being, like a pressure down on our being. And so we're bearing that weight. Now, the thing that is important to understand is two things can happen. Number one, if the information is just basically, let's say it's hoarded, you hold on to it, and then there are some difficulties, some different, you know, obstacles that we have to face, etc. When we look at it, then there's a problem. And then the problem that we have to face is the vessel strong enough to hold all of that divine presence? Okay? And if the vessel is not allowed or doesn't have the capacity to hold the divine presence, then number one, it can leak. It can allow some of that to weep out of us. And number two, it could actually cause a fracture. It can cause it to just seep out, or it can break, and then the vessel will burst. And as the vessel bursts, then there's going to be an outflow of the divine presence that comes out of us. Now, one of the ways to understand how the side of negativity gets its power is from the vessels breaking, okay? And when I say the vessels breaking, I'm speaking about ourselves as the vessels. I'm not so much concerned with or talking about those that don't have the resting of the divine presence on them. I'm talking about those that are the Neshamot Kedem, or the ancient souls, or the righteous souls. And when we look at this and stop to think about this, the weight as it sets down on us, we either are able to retain it and hold on to it, or we'll fracture and break. And if we fracture and break, then we allow the chef of the divine presence, the flow of the divine presence, out in a way that is not a positive way. When it goes out and it's not used in the appropriate way, then it strengthens and gives light to the other side. Now, the other side doesn't actually become purer from it. They use it as a methodology of negativity, okay? So this is one of the reasons why the side of negativity, whether you want to call it the devil or whatever you want to say, however you want to say it, it doesn't want you to obey it as a specific command. All right, because listen, if it makes you do something and it's responsible, then it is responsible and it has to pay for its punishment. So what it doesn't want to do is force you. It wants to influence you. And then once it influences you, you use your will to do some act of negativity. When you do that, you're channeling some of this divine presence, the chef of the abundance, that is actually a life force to us, a spiritual life force. It has come down to come down into us, but we actually channel it out. And there are many, many negativities that we use. People don't realize they're doing this, but there are many negativities that they use and that actually cause this to happen. Okay. But now in the simplest way to explain the most positive idea of this system is that we receive the weight. Once we receive the weight, it comes to us, even though it's weight, it's light, but it turns into a spiritual weight, like a spiritual gravity, and it needs to come out. It needs to have an outflow. So it has to flow out of you in some way. If you use it appropriate in the outflow, if you use it as a ministry method or your methodology for giving out, you know, the word of God, the Dabar Elohim, etc., if you're giving it out, then what happens is it will flow through you. It will flow into another vessel. They'll receive it in the appropriate way, and then they'll give it out. And this may be a form of, you know, moving from one source down to another, to another, to another. But you shouldn't find any negativity in wherever you become the source or wherever you become the recipient in the process. And all of that being said, then the most appropriate way to strengthen your vessel as you know, a vessel that has to periodically retain the amount of spirituality that you hold on to has to be that it flows through you. When it flows through you, then it strengthens the whole vessel. It basically, for lack of better expression, it thickens the walls of your spirituality, and then you contain it, you can hold on to it. You may only need to hold on to it for a short period of time, but then you allow it to flow through you, and then it happens. If it keeps flowing through other people, then they are strengthened as well in this entire process. So that is, you know, the optimal choice is to let it flow through you. And if it flows through you, then you are at a place where you're actually being very positive in the use of the light, and you're using the light in the right methodology. If you don't use the light in the appropriate methodology, then your vessel can crack, and some of the kivod, as it were, can stream out of you, leak out of you, or again, it can burst. If it bursts, then the flow can be a catastrophe, okay? And when this does happen, and it does happen to some people, they don't realize what's going on, but they receive in some measure, they receive an overflow that is too much. And when they get more than they should have at that particular moment, they can either, you know, fracture or they can burst. And when those things happen, you know, it turns into, you know, a breakdown of some sort. We've all had them. You know, it's not something that you're going to end up in the loony bin. It's that, you know, you got to restructure yourself to, you know, receive the light, and etc. Now, there are some things that can influence this when you're receiving it from others, and that is if someone doesn't know how to appropriately dispense the light to other people, to other students or whatever. So I'm just going to put it like this. If you got a bad teacher, look out, because what's going to happen is the bad teacher doesn't have any tact or diplomacy when they're serving out the word of God. And if they don't have any tact or diplomacy when they're doing it, it actually can cause you problems, but it's bursting out of them in an inappropriate way. They're using it in the wrong way. So really, their vessel is breaking, and they're letting it come out in an inappropriate way. When it comes out like that, most chances are the people that are in the line of flow will receive the fracture as well. And so you have to learn that even when someone is in the process of dispensing the Shefa, the divine flow, that they're doing it right. And if you notice that something is not right, then it's not inappropriate for you to raise your guard, okay? You don't have to make an issue out of it, but at the same time, you can raise your guard, and what you're trying to do is protect yourself, your spirituality in the process. And so, you know, people that do those kind of things and are not appropriate in their methodology of actually allowing the light to flow through them can damage others without even knowing they're doing so, and probably in those cases even caring whether they're hurting somebody or somebody else. And so this brings it back to the teacher, us as a teacher, you as a teacher, that you should have the same consideration. And one of the things that needs to happen when we allow this light to flow out of us is to have a flapper on the mouth. And there is a flapper in the mouth. And if you learn how to use the flapper in the mouth, then you don't need a flapper on the outside of the mouth, right? So the whole point here is that really the flapper is controlled by something up here. And if the whole process doesn't flow in the appropriate, smooth process, then you need to learn how to control what you say to certain people because they're not ready for it. Okay, and then you can cause a problem for others when you do this. And I've talked a little bit about this. I've had revelation knowledge that I've held on to for years that I would not reveal, because not because I didn't think that the people could handle it, it's that I didn't know how to articulate it. And if I didn't know how to articulate this truth, then I could turn into a situation of hurting somebody else by giving them this light and it being too much for them to receive or hold on to at that particular moment. So once we understand basically that in this process there are some mechanics, and some of the mechanics are not mechanics that we have to sit there and absolutely say, I need step one, I need step two, I need step three for receiving spiritual Shefa and Hashpa'ah, which is the bestowal, okay? Hashpa'ah turns into be the gift, okay? The gift of what you receive. And the Shefa is that constant flow. And as it constantly flows in you, out you, through you, then the whole process, if it's done correctly, it's a strengthening measure, and it's a strengthening measure for all who receive it. Okay? So, you know, basically, the idea here is that we're going to receive spiritual influx. If you're a spiritual person, you will receive the divine presence. You'll receive the weight of the divine presence coming down upon you. As you receive that weight, then again, you're going to do one of two things. You're going to have to give it out, or you're going to have to hold on to it for the period of time that you need until the appropriate person, vessel, or whatever comes for you to pour into. Okay, there's a story in the prophets where a woman was behind on her rent, and I'm paraphrasing the idea, but you know, the only thing she had was a pot and she had some oil. And when she knew that she needed to do something to actually increase her receptivity, then the prophet told her, go borrow all the pans in the neighborhood. Go borrow all the pots and pans you can, and then started to pour the oil from vessel to vessel to vessel to vessel, and it filled up all of the different vessels, and there still was a flow, okay? This is Shefa. This is how it works with the Spirit of God as it comes. When the Spirit comes to rest on you, it's not just there to rest on you for you to sit there and go, oh, such a warm, wonderful feeling. I feel so good, and, you know, I just love myself right now and all of that, okay? And it really, you know, the sad thing is if you really do feel that way, if that's the sensation you're feeling, you're wrong. It's the inappropriate way to understand. To feel the euphoria of the Shefa is a very important thing, but you don't want to get it, hold on to it, and just bask in the warmth of it. You can for a period of time as long as it's not ego-driven. If the ego gets in the middle of the process, then you're in trouble. Because then the ego starts to say, me, 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 I, and think about itself and think that, oh, aren't I such a wonderful whatever, okay? And that is a dangerous, dangerous thing, especially when you're talking about the divine influx flowing into you and then ego taking a place. What's going to happen? Easy enough to tell you, it's going to break. Because the ego cannot, it will inflate, but it usually inflates with hot air, not spirituality. You know what I'm saying? So the hot air is negativity. When it inflates with spirituality, what it wants to do is flow out. And it wants to flow out to those who contain it. So one of the most important things is to try to be aware of the amount of light that you're receiving. And you don't have to do it like this, but this is just a way of understanding it. When you receive the light, whatever it might be something in your studies, your personal studies. It might be in you listening to a lecture or a rabbi or whatever. When you receive that light, the whole idea, again, is to share that light. But as you receive that light, the whole idea is that it's for your spiritual elevation. But spiritual elevation does not mean you just moved up a notch. It also means that your capacity has to increase and has to be greater. And the reason is like the analogy of the woman and the pots. What you have to do is feed more people in the community with the light. You see what I'm saying? So instead of sitting on it and thinking that, you know, wow, this is wonderful, you know, I'm going to write this in my journal and then, you know, I can come back in a year and look at my journal and I can remember and all of this. Well, you know, that's a positivity, etc. But the light is not flowing for the sake of your journal, although you might want to, you should journal or whatever. I don't journal in that way, but, you know, I keep strict notes on, you know, what I do. And I take them in voluminous and copious amounts. And so the thing being that, you know, once I gather the information, what good is it if it's just, you know, 85 pages of data and it's sitting in your computer? Oh, I have all this data. I have all this information. It's so important. It doesn't mean anything if it's just something that the hard drives have to review once in a while to see what's in the system. But the point being is that it all should be shared. But once we realize that there is a light coming and there is a light that we're receiving, there's something called the aperture. And aperture is a very interesting idea. So the aperture can be small, it can be great, it can be whatever. You know, if you get film that, well, let's put it this way, film back in the day when you used film, you know, you would have a slower rate or a low light film. And what that meant was the aperture had to stay open for a longer time. And, of course, that requires you to be very still with the camera so that it can open and it stays open for that whatever split second that it is. And then it can take light into a darker background. Okay, and then, you know, in daylight systems, the aperture would be very fast, and it would open and close very, very rapidly. And, you know, there's one of the gentlemen that most of us in this room probably have heard of, or many have, a few may not have heard, but his name is Watchman Nee. And Watchman Nee talks about the ministry of God's Word. And when he talks about the ministry of God's Word, he uses this same analogy of aperture. And he basically says what happens is revelation knowledge comes because what happens in the spiritual man is the spiritual man, let's just use an analogy, it opens its eye, and then it closes. The impression of the divine light has burned an image on the inside of the spiritual man. When that image is burned into the inside of the man or the spiritual part of man, then what we have to do is we have to review the image. And when we review the image, then we can review the light. And then, of course, the idea is to minister that out of ourselves. But one of the problems is that you have to be able to hold on to the image. Okay? So with the camera, we understand the camera. We understand the simplicity of making a picture or having it on your phone or whatever. However we do it in the contemporary age, we can look at the picture. And then the Kabbalists say a picture is worth 1,000 words. Okay, that's because when you start to look at all the details in a picture, you see things that you might not have remembered when the aperture opened and closed in that fragmentary second or moment or whatever it might have been. Okay, so no, this is the case of your spirituality. All right, so when the aperture opens and you receive an impression of spiritual light, it's a burned, let's say, onto a slide inside of your spiritual man. Now, for a period of time, what you're going to be able to do is go back and look at that image or remember it in your spiritual memory and remember the basic details of it. But sometimes we need to slow focus. And when we slow focus, what we're doing is we're receiving the whole image and being able to review the whole image. And, you know, remember those little highlights that we used to get when we were in grade school? And then they had a picture of somebody or something that's a cat hidden in a tree. Can you find the cat hidden in your tree? And you look at the thing and you couldn't see the cat for anything, you know. And then finally you turn to the back page and it shows you where the cat was or whatever, you know. And so it's the same situation here. But then we can take it on this idea of, let's say, a 5,000 piece puzzle. Okay? And so you got a piece of puzzle laying out on your desk, and it's 5,000 pieces. And how do you put the thing together? Well, this looks like it should go here, and you're looking for shape and all that. But when all else fails, what do? Turn over the box, right? Because then that way you can see that, oh, there's blue here in the sky and whatever the situation might be. Okay, so in one sense, this is the mechanism of the light coming in and the weight of the divine presence sitting down on you. And here's the idea. Number one, if you take a glass out of your cupboard, and you fill it with whatever form of liquid that you want to put in it, chances are it's not going to break, okay? Most of the time, the glass is designed to handle at least, you know, a few ounces of water, right? But if you step on it or drop it, it could fracture and break. And that's because it was not designed in that particular function to function like that, okay? And so this is the same thing for us. But if you take, let's say, 1,000 pounds, let's just say as an example, and you set a cup or a glass on, say, a surface, a solid surface, and then you release the weight of that weight onto the glass, it may stand up if it's, you know, a really solid piece of glass or whatever. But if it doesn't stand up, then a couple of things are going to happen. It may at first be able to bear a great amount of the load, but if it cannot bear the full weight of the load, a crack is going to start. And then once the crack starts, chances are then you're going to have a collapse. You're going to have a breakage of, you know, the device. But if you set it down on there nice and gentle, it may stand for a period of time. I've got some glasses in my cupboard that, you know, I think you could probably put a whole semi on top of that glass and it wouldn't break. You know what I mean? But then again, you know, I know that there are some glasses in my cupboard that you couldn't put, you know, your own human weight just on the glass because it would break it. It would fracture like that. So what we're talking about is the weight of the divine presence. How much of that weight can you stand? How much can you hold up? How can you retain it? And basically understand that you have here an interaction with the divine presence. And this is one of the ways that we do interact with the divine presence. Otherwise, you know, why would they be talking about the kibbutz of glory? It can be analogous. And it can be an allegory, it can be even midrash, and it can even be so'od. But nevertheless, the whole point is receiving the weight of the divine presence means that your vessel has to be a strong enough vessel to hold the amount of the divine presence that you want to hold. And when it's all said and done, what do you want? I want to hold as much as I possibly can. And before I break. And we don't really, really want to break, even though we might think that, go ahead and break me. You know, I've said sometimes that there's this idea of receiving too much light, right? If you receive too much light and the brain gets too much light, you might get scorched. And then I say, go ahead and scorch me. It's okay. You know what I mean? But in reality, the point is that once you feel that weight, and many times you really can feel this in a spiritual sense of the divine presence just resting down on you. And as you feel the divine presence resting down on you, this presence is there. But most of us have this intent that it's there for us. It's mine, and I don't care what you want, it's mine. But Moshe, in one sense, kind of had this lesson. And the lesson was that the full weight of the Torah was resting on him. Okay? He received the full weight of the Torah. So now when 600,000 Jews have issues, and you got 600,000 Jews, you got over a million issues. Okay? But the thing is here, you can't be the only one to dispense light. You can't be the only one to dispense Torah. You have to be able to dispense Torah to others, and they have to be able to dispense Torah, and they have to be able to dispense Torah. But in Moshe's case, what happened was the whole weight of the Torah, the divine presence, all of the weight of the divine presence was resting on Moshe. Then, of course, between Yitro and between Hashem, we have this awareness that this weight has to be dispersed and spread out over more than one person. So you take, you know, the elders, he brings the elders, and, excuse me, what he does is he receives the light, and then he lets the light not just set upon himself, but he spreads it out over the 70 elders, and now they can bear a greater weight of the divine presence. And it's interesting because it's kind of like the four blind men and the elephant. Okay? What part did you have? Well, the part that I have, that the elephant is like a tree trunk. Okay? Blah, blah, blah. You know the story. So the interesting thing is that each one of us receive a weight of that Torah. And something that's going on here is that we have it inside of a community. But we have more of a specialized Torah in a certain sense because we look at it from the septennial reading cycle. And so that means that we have insights that others do not. And it's not for us to, as a group, to just hold it, but as a group, we can contain and hold a greater amount of weight. If we're not just a single individual, we have a greater amount of weight that we can hold because we do it collectively. But collective is still, you have your piece and I have my piece and one has another piece, etc. And these have to all flow together in a system. And so this being said, we have the idea that the weight, once it rests on us, once the divine glory comes down and rests upon us, then we're supposed to have some dispersion. We're supposed to give it out. And then we're supposed to be this flowing measure of it. So we come in contact with this idea of aperture. And aperture tells us, tells you, tells me, just how much I can stand. And then there are ways of dealing with this, okay? I know when I'm working here in my office that the divine presence is here. I know that the Shefa is flowing. And then there's sometimes when the light comes that I have to get up and leave the room. I can't stay here. I have to get up and move because I can't process the data because I'm so inner-focused that it's myopic. I'm just seeing this one little view of it. So I'll get up and walk to the other room, look out the window, look out the door, whatever. But of course, your mind is still engaged with the divine presence. And as you're doing this, then what happens is the picture that you received can start to be broken down into the fragments of the picture that it is, basically, or the segments of the picture, etc. And so aperture doesn't just mean, you know, how much light we get. It means the amount of the appropriate light we get. And it also means to stop when you receive a point when you can't receive any more of the light that is coming down on us. And so that being said, you know, we have to understand some principles. Number one, how do you hold it? How do you receive the light and hold it? One second, please. Number one, or basically at the top of the list, has to be consistent obedience. Okay, you have to have a relationship with the divine presence to begin with. Okay, if you have a relationship with the divine presence, then there's going to be interaction, regardless of what you might think. There's going to be an interaction. And you can't be involved in things that are displeasing to the divine presence. And if you are, then the consistency of obedience stops the flow of that light. Now, don't be worried, because Israel had this problem, right? And it said, you know, when Adam, you know, had his inconsistency, said the divine presence lifted up off of the world at that particular point, okay? And so there's a certain idea now that the divine presence is resting on Israel, but at the same time, it said the divine presence is Israel. Okay? And so if you accept that, that means you're a manifestation of the divine presence. If you're a manifestation of the divine presence and the weight of that glory is resting on you, then you have to carry the weight of that glory no matter where you go. Okay? Suppose everybody in the neighborhood knows you're this God-fearing person, and then you do some act of negativity. And when you do that act of negativity, then what happens? Okay, then you gain a reputation for, well, just because they say they're whatever, it is this or that. Okay, so the idea first is have a consistent a consistent obedience to specifically the Torah, but to those places and those ideals that are those that are God, and, you know, connected with God and connected with the flow of the Torah, okay? And the next thing you need to have is some discipline, okay? And that means that, number one, you have discipline in your activities, meaning that, you know, sometimes we go here, we go there, we do these things. You know, we always have to see ourselves as an ambassador, and an ambassador for God, an ambassador for the divine presence. And, you know, sometimes when you get in circles that are, how can I say, they're a little bit more receptive than other circles, because you have some people that are a little more receptive and they can sense something about you. They will sense the divine presence and they will know it's there. And so then once you have developed that particular level of connection, then what you have to do is you have to make sure you maintain that persona of who you are, etc. Okay? And that being said, you know, it calls for discipline, and it's discipline activities and disciplined action. But one of the other things that is more damaging than most people really realize is called Lashon Hara. And that is called, you know, the evil tongue, okay? And while I say Lashon Hara, it doesn't even have to be just, quote, Lashon Hara. We have to guard speech regardless. And if people know, you know, your speech patterns and they know where you're at, they know the level of sanctity that you have, okay? But sometimes, you know, you can push the boundaries of what people know and understand without disregarding the divine presence. And so, and most people think that, you know, Yeshua never said a curse word and he never did anything of negativity. Well, I don't think he necessarily did anything of negativity. But, and I don't think that he ever necessarily used the curse word, but he used some synonyms that were pretty frank, okay? During the time of, you know, the first century, you know, if you called somebody a fox, meant that, you know, this person has some qualities that are, how can we say, more political than spiritual? And isn't that what he said about Herod? He said, you go tell that old fox this. So he was using a little bit of a derogatory term with regards to him, just without just blatantly saying that, you know, he's whatever, he insinuates these things. And so that being said, you still have this idea of your speech being something that you need to control and something that you need to guard. And one of the other things, a couple of things that can be situational in this process is that, you know, we have relatively stable routines. This doesn't mean being in stuck in a rut, like we talk about mediocrity before, but it doesn't mean being stuck in a rut, but it means to have a stable life, you know. So you get up in the morning, you say the Modeani, you know. Is that, you know, absolutely mandatory? It should be mandatory, but if something comes and interrupts it, it is, you know, a different thing. Same thing with, you know, other aspects. But you can generally tell people who are spiritual people because their conduct is spiritual conduct. It's not conduct of some raging maniac from on the outside, okay? And then the other thing is that one of the things that you can do is make sure that you stay inside of that place of constant flow. You want to have a constant flow. Now, if you have a constant flow, basically what that's going to mean is not only do you have the constant flow, it means you have the constant output. Okay? So, as this relates to the levels of the neshama, the first level that we reach is the nefesh in the bottom level, and it's the level of activity. So this goes back to the fact that you should have positive activities, things that are not questionable activities. You know, if you go out at night and they see you with one of those clothes hangers trying to pop the latch on somebody else's car, they're going to start to get, you know, this question about, you know, why were you doing that? Well, he locked his keys in his car. I was helping him out, okay? Or, you know, well, it was only you. Well, I was just doing it for him so he could, I could take his keys to him or whatever, right? So the nefesh is the place of activity. And Psalms 55:18 comes into play in this particular point. And David is saying here, and he's talking here about receiving the deeper levels of spirituality. And he said the battle that he had it with peace. And he said the troubles that he had were great. And it says, it can be read that the troubles that he had were many, but he's referring to the battles that he's facing in his soul. So the difficulties in that particular set of verses could be that what? The difficulty that you're facing is the nefesh. The nefesh has an appetite, and the appetite of the nefesh is a bit more on the animal level. And when I say animal, I don't mean absolutely animal. I mean, it's the physical portion of us that I gotta eat, I gotta whatever, you know, I need some sleep now, whatever the question or whatever the situation might start to be. And then the next level of, you know, this divine presence and its association with the weight of God's glory resting on us is the Ruach. And so naturally understood, the Ruach is associated, number one, with breathing, but breathing is breathing, but the idea is to be breathing the Word of God, okay, or breathing out the spirituality that we have. And that means speaking. And if you guys go back a few weeks, you remember the 5786, 86 is the word po, meaning it has to come out of your mouth. And so if it comes out of our mouth, then this is where the Ruach comes in. And then it's more like, you know, if you set the divine presence, the weight of the divine presence down upon yourself, if you receive the weight of the divine presence, then the spigot for the divine flow can be the mouth, where you're teaching or speaking out the divine presence out of your mouth and all of that. And then the neshama comes into play. Now, the interesting thing about the neshama is it is higher seeking. And so if the spirit wants to elevate, it's actually being elevated by the neshama in many and in most cases. And that means that the neshama is actually seeking a higher connection anyway. All right. And so whatever measure of the divine presence that I have right now, that's not enough. I want to elevate. And so its natural appetite is light. Its natural appetite is light. And so it wants light. And it wants all the light that it can do, it can receive. And if it had its way, it would choke what is below it, the Ruach and the Nefesh, okay? And if the teacher is not seasoned in their administration of the Torah, then what happens is they can start to administrate, you know, things that are beyond what those below them can understand and receive, and that they can actually turn into a place of choking people out. And that's a great difficulty. But the one point is, you know, of course, many people think that, you know, every minute of the day, I need to be listening to a rabbi teaching the Torah. That is not true. Okay? Because you don't have time to process that much data. And if it's a Torah, if it's a rabbi and the rabbi speaking Torah, and it's Torah that is Torah, then when it's going into you, It's saturating your presence. It's filling your presence, and you get too much of it, and you won't contain the things that are associated with yourself, and those are connected to yourself, okay? So the neshama, in and of itself, has an appetite for light. It wants all of it that it can get. It wants all of it that it can transmit. It wants to pour it out in its greatest measures that it possibly can do, okay? And then the next life force, or the next force, is Chaya. Chaya is the power of divine strength and energy and movement, okay? And once the Kavod lands or rests on the divine presence, then what we have is this point of dispersion. It comes into the neshama. The neshama receives it, but the empowerment comes for you to be doing something about it by speaking about it, telling others about it, etc. Okay, and then the final thing that I'm going to end with is this idea of sealing the vessel. And believe me, we haven't got hardly halfway through the lesson on the whole process. Okay, when the vessel starts to fracture, okay, let's say that it has a crack in it. You know, there's ways that, you know, this happens. There's ways that this whole process begins, okay? When Dean is involved, heat is involved, okay? So when judgment is involved, so is heat, or what we call entropy. When entropy comes, there's always a friction. There's always heat that, you know, heats something up. So you put that inside of a vessel, and let's just say you have a metal pot, you know. The more heat you put on one isolated piece of the pot means that what's happening now is that it's thinning. And as it starts to thin, then, you know, it could have a little bit of a pinhole in it. And then out comes the fluid that's in it. Now, in California, working in California, there is a lot of rock, a lot of limestone rock, a lot of granite, a lot of different forms of rock. And so we were working on a campground in Southern California and building the campground into, you know, a bigger campground and odds and ends. But nevertheless, we had to put a sewer line in, and the sewer line had to go 6 miles away from the camp. And it went down around the hill and down the hill, way down into the bottom where field lines went for the system. So I was digging across this section of this process and got a hold of this rock. And we used then a special form of teeth. And the teeth looked like basically like a claw. And when you use them, it's not like the normal teeth on a normal backhoe bucket or something like that. They, here in this part of the country, they call them tiger teeth. And they're on long points, and they sort of make a V, and then you take those points and you drag those points through the ground, and it will, you know, break up the granite. So I got a hold of something, and I knew that either it's a big rock and I'm going to have to dig it out and get it out of the side of the hill so that we can put the sewer line through there, because it has to flow on a specific rate, etc. And then all of a sudden I said to my brother, I said, look and see what that is. And he gets the shovel and he goes there and he scratches for a second, and then he looks for a minute, and then he jumps back. And what happened was, there was a water main that went through there. Not even supposed to be there, of course. And the water main that went through there was, you know, about an 8-inch line. And it had a groove in it from one of those teeth. Okay? So when that groove went through the metal, it actually caused a rut in the metal. And it thinned so much that when he was looking at it to see what happened, it dimpled up from the pressure on the inside of the line. It did not break, but it dimpled up. And this is why he jumped back, because he thought the thing now was going to burst and, you know, we're going to have a landslide from all the water that was there. So they call this team of guys to come out, find out, you know, if this is their water line. Sure enough, it was their water line. It's not supposed to be here. It's supposed to be 2 miles down the road. That's interesting. So what the gentleman did was, I thought, are you going to just stick a stick and start welding on that thing right there like that with that gouge in the middle of it? He goes, no, son. He said, I got a little bit more experience than that. And I thought, okay, this is worth watching. He took a ball peen hammer, for those women that know what it is, it's a round nose hammer. And he started around the outside of that whole split that was made by the tooth, and he took and he drove the metal toward the inside. And it took him about an hour and a half, and finally he had that actually covered over. And then he took his welder, and then again he starts on the outside, and he comes and he begins to weld till he gets right over the spot. And then it's thickened, it's widened, and we don't have to worry about this fracture and it blowing water all over everything. But this is one of the things that we have to understand in spirituality, and in the case with you know, the weight of God's glory. One of the things that we have to receive is the weight. But sometimes, you know, when the weight gets to be too much, we have to shift the load. We have to either have somebody help carry it or stop receiving, you know, an extra amount of information at that particular juncture so we can process some data, or we have to do something in a way that it will actually allow us to alleviate some of the pressure off of the stress point. And then after we have alleviated the pressure, we have to make sure that we maintain a specific flow of that particular divine essence. Otherwise, again, we could fracture. But one of the most awesome things about this is that, generally speaking, you know, the fracture doesn't come unless there's some practice of negativity. And I'm not talking about walking around in sin or anything like that. I'm just saying sometimes we get some bad habits and we don't realize it. And we do those things, we can't contain, you know, the divine presence, the weight of the divine presence. And so the whole mechanism behind, you know, the little bit that I shared with you out of, you know, what I have received in this particular process is to understand that, number one, we receive the divine presence and that we bear the weight of the divine presence and we're responsible for that. But the other thing is, you know, the maintenance of sharing that and handing that down to others and giving it to others is a vital, important thing. You cannot hold on to it just by yourself. The Torah is more than all of us, and trying to hold on to the Torah is important. And we have our place and our portion in the Torah. But if we don't share that Torah, then our portion gets distorted, and then we become a vessel that's not able to contain the divine presence. And this happened with Israel considerably. Okay, one of their major faults was what they suffer with today, and that's assimilation. And so if you think that you want to look like everybody else and act and talk and walk like everybody else, and you don't want to be what God called you to be, you're definitely going to not be able to withstand the weight of the divine presence. But the whole point is that we can bear the weight of the divine presence, and each one of us has a measure to do that. But the best way to make sure that the walls are strengthened and thickened is that you allow the flow. One story before I go. I lived for a period of time up in a city called North City. I actually lived on the outside when I was going to Bible college. And they were working on a system, a farm next door to where I was staying at that particular time. And they dug up some PVC pipe that they didn't need in the field anymore that crossed that particular field. And he laid it out there on the ground. And I said, What do you think about how fast that will straighten out? And because it's in a curve, you know. And I told him, it's been my luck that it never will straighten out. And he said, well, son, he said, let me tell you this. He said, we've done studies on PVC pipe now for over 40 years. And one of the things that we understand about PVC pipe when it's in the ground is the longer it's in the ground, the harder it gets. Not brittle, harder. And the harder it gets, and if it's put in a bit of a strain where it's in a curve or something where you bend it around a little bit, said, you take it out of the ground, you got to find the same curve to put it back into because it will never straighten out. And so this process tells us about the idea of being used for the weight of the divine presence. When the pressure flows through us, we're strengthened. If it doesn't flow through us and we in some way, you know, minimize, you know, the process, then we cause, you know, some sort of a fracture, a fracture and a breakage. End of my rant. Questions and comments. You are the vessel holding the whole divine presence up. Everybody's good? Okay. Don Shlomo, hang on 1 second, sir. I apologize. Okay, go ahead.
It does, though, but the post you sent out this just last day or two about Romans 8.
Yes, sir.
And this idea of staying steady.
Yeah.
And receiving the kavod while we're waiting on that manifestation of the sons of God.
Right.
I kind of have thought that it may have nothing to do with what you're saying tonight, but that in that Romans passage, it's like for those that overcome and are deemed worthy, that when that day comes, they're going to operate at a higher level, but we know now that that's more so maybe that the Sephiroth are going to operate in their life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree.
You know, at a higher level.
Yes.
Than does now.
Yes.
And that doesn't seem to be for everybody.
I agree.
So, what do you think about that?
Okay, first of all, if you look at 2 Corinthians 4 and 17, and then you look at the last few verses, five verses of or eight verses of Romans, where it's 31 through 39. This actually has a connection to that verse. And the idea is exactly what you're saying. Number one, the all of creation, and we talked about this last night, was it? In the Wednesday night college class, we talked about this, that all of creation is waiting for the sons of God. And the manifestation of the sons of God is exactly what you're saying. There is going to, I think in Paul was seeing that there is a greater level of kibod that is going to come in these last days. And that this is going to be part of the revelation that we need to bring us into the next phase of the 1,000 years or whatever. But I think that that's part of what is being said. All of creation is groaning. And then he also says that our body is groaning. But that's because we have a spiritual awareness of something that is beyond the level of the natural world. And I think it takes first the healing of the natural world. And that process I discussed a little bit last night comes through Da'at. but we had a problem with Deot for you know, nearly two or three millennia, in that it was the marriage between good and evil. And so Da'at was something that had to use discernment. But once we receive the Torah, then we have a gauge where we can determine what is right and what is wrong. And so that reception was something that I think is part of the process that will help lead us. But in those classes, we all also been talking about a couple of things from the covenant of Jeremiah, and the covenant that it's talked about in Ezekiel, and that is that we have the Torah within us. He says, Torati Ruachayim, inside they have my Torah of life. And it, once that's inside of us, and then he also says in Ezekiel 36:27, he said, my spirit is on the inside. And then when you start to put that inside, the Torah inside, and then of course Romans 8 tells you what you know well, he said, my spirit will lead the sons of God. Okay, but really, in order to understand that verse, you got to go back to verse 2, and verse 2 says that how do we escape the condemnation? And that's through the instruction of the Ruach HaKodesh. And so those things being said, what I'm saying is there's a man on the horizon that, and I think that that's not just one man. I think that's those that have that capacity will raise to that new level of spirituality. And I think that that is something that will influence the future. Exactly how that's going to do that is a difficulty, because of course, you know, we're talking about men like Moshe, Yeshua, etc. So, but he's basically, I think Paul is saying, now we've had this for some time now, and it's time for us to be flowering that flower. Does that answer anything?
Yeah, and you know, when they came to Yeshua and he asked them who David was talking about when he called him Lord.
Yeah.
That's connected to Psalms 110:1.
Yes.
Where the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand.
Yes.
So I'll make enemies your footstool. Well, I was reading just today, and there's this understanding that that position that Jesus took at that time was what everybody believed. It was the standard position.
I think that that's right.
And so that the Messiah was a divine Messiah that comes from the presence of Hashem to rule the earth.
Yeah.
So with that being said, I have often thought that in some way the souls are all connected to this first creation of God, Messiah.
Yeah.
And how I would separate the soul that is a Jewish soul and the soul that is a Gentile soul, I don't know. Maybe they're all connected and maybe they're not. Maybe one's a little closer and one's a little farther away. It's kind of like in a family, you know, you have firstborn son and then the sixth-born
yeah.
son.
Right, right.
And so there's just a difference. But what I've seen in this is that there seems to be, from what you're saying and what Paul is saying, that there's going to come a day when those that are worthy are going to step into a place that they haven't experienced before.
I agree. I agree. They can see it on the horizon, but they just haven't.
Yeah, and I wouldn't call that, in the way I look at it, I wouldn't call that we become some kind of spiritual being that we're not today.
No, I don't think that.
It's just that our soul gets elevated somehow.
I think that's right.
And we begin to walk and function at a much higher dimension.
I agree. I agree.
And one of the things that always has puzzled me is for those of us that have a desire to serve God.
Yeah.
and it's a big part of our life.
Right.
And then all the people that we know, they don't have any desire at all. They never think about God till mama gets sick, you know?
Yeah.
And that dichotomy has just always been amazing to me.
I can't really, you know, I can say things about that, but I can't, you know, and it would be opinionation, and that's all it is. And, you know, I say, you know, everybody's got an opinion and everybody has a belly button too. Don't go sniffing around down there because they don't smell good all the time. But the point there is that, look at, just, you know, we have these opinions, and I have opinions about the situation. But some of the things I can say with a relative amount of sincerity is that, you know, when you talk to Jewish people, when God's speaking to the Jewish people, and they've, you know, drifted into one way or the other, no matter what it is, he always tells them to return. But when you see in Acts, and you see in Romans 1 and 5, he says that, Paul says that his duty was to call the Gentiles into obedience, is what he says in Romans 1 and 5. And then, and I believe obviously that that is to the Torah, but then when you read in Acts chapter 10, you see Cornelius come in, and I believe that he comes into conversion, and how I determine this is because he says first, these have received the Spirit. And I think that what he's saying there is they received the Nefesh Yehudi, which is the Jewish soul. And if they received the Jewish soul, then you, however you want to say it, I believe they become Jewish. Okay. That being said, when you read in Acts chapter 15, he does not say that, James does not say that the Gentiles are returning to God. He said the Gentiles are turning towards God. So in that process, how God selected those souls, I have no idea. I can't answer that. I told His Eminence once that I think that the Jewish souls we see in Gentiles today in a measure comes from the result of the Shoah in the 6 million that were destroyed. And some of those souls that they should have had, children they should have had, the souls came into some of us. And he said, His Eminence, Rabbi Yosef Ovadia, said the same exact thing. That's not to validate what I said, but that he said the same thing. He saw that as a situation for that. So how to explain the Gentile receiving it, the Nefesh Yehudi, I can do it like that. But as far as the rest of the soul, I don't, I can't, I can say things that I think are right. And I can say things that I think, I'll tell you this, and then you see how you agree with it or don't agree with it. But we had this discussion going on inside of this congregation here not too long ago. And I said something about some of the souls are not souls of God at all. And they're not even associated with that. Now, you can make that Hitler, you can make that Mussolini, you can whatever you want to make it. I'm not that judge, so I'm not trying to make that stance. But when you look at the temptation in the garden and then the dispensement of judgment by God, he said that the serpent would have children, and those children would be oppose the children of the woman. And so when you get that in there, there has to be some fragment of something in there that perhaps we don't understand, but somehow the other side, whether it's, I can't explain it. I'm not even going to try to explain it, because somehow the other side has its minion, its army or whatever, and how they're animated and how that functions, that's beyond my pay grade. I can't answer that. But I think you're absolutely right with regards to the fact that, you know, one of these days we're going to come to the full weight of even some of the things like this that we've been discussing. You know, you stop and think that, you know, the glory of God is, you're the house of God's glory. Someday that's got to come to a place that it means something beyond just, oh, isn't it nice? I got this wonderful feeling today, and I just knew that. It has to come to a realization in some way or another that it and I think you're right. I don't think that we're going to, you know, get this brand new thing come down and insert itself into us, and then, you know, you magically wiggle your nose and you become something else. I think it's a process of transformation. And I've said this for years and years and years. So I think in that aspect, you're absolutely right. As far as the rest of it goes, it's kind of like the sages say about, you know, Messiah, he can't come on the Sabbath. And the one rabbi was praying for him to come on the Sabbath. And he said, you can't do that, Rabbi. He says, if Messiah comes on their Sabbath, it's not right. He goes, that's not my problem. Let Messiah figure it out. So the rest of the stuff he shows me, I can say something about. I say it if I can.
Well, just one more point. I was reading today, this week, in Isaiah 42, where God is talking about that servant that he chose to be a light.
Yep.
And, you know, there's a lot of discussion about that, but in my mind, there's not a doubt that that servant is Israel. And then, yes, it's personified in the one, the Messiah.
Yeah, exactly.
There's an interesting little phrase or half a verse in that chapter that says that the covenant that God made with Israel, he made because of their forefathers.
I agree with that.
And so it's like, I guess if we are a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob,
yes,
then we're in that covenant.
Yeah.
And it's not us, it's them and what they done and the agreement God made with them.
I agree with that.
But we have that connection.
Right. And there's an answer right there, I think, in some capacity. I have to fish it out, but I think that's in and of itself. Are you one of Abraham's children?
Right. And that's an interesting point you made about the Gentiles in Acts 15.
Yeah.
It doesn't say they're returning. It says they're turning
to God, yes.
Yeah. And so,
One of the other things you pointed out, though, you know, is about, you know, Messiah being like number one in the line of that lineage. Romans does it there. If you go back just a few verses, of course, and it says, you know, he's the firstborn and then he's the heir. And then now we become joint heirs with him. So that means he has to been the first one. You know what I'm saying? So in my cosmology, where we start up in that realm up there, and then we decide to come down here, he has to be the first guy to leave. But I see that, this is my way of seeing it. Number one, when you read in the beginning, Elohim, we know Elohim is not Hashem, okay? Elohim created the heavens and the earth, okay? And then it says, verse 2 said, and the Ruach Elohim agitated the face of the waters. And the sages say that the Ruach Elohim is Messiah. Okay? So counter your hermeneutic, go backwards. If the Ruach Elohim is Messiah, Elohim is Elohim of the first verse is Messiah. So then you have Colossians 1 and 15, right? Said he was made in the image of God, but he's the creator of all of these things. So that's how I would see them saying that Yeshua is, you know, the first of all of that and that he's the creator. Now, whether that theologically figures out, that's a whole nother story, but that's not my problem either. So but that's how I try to explain it to the best of my knowledge. But I think one of the things you just said that is worth its weight in gold is probably the Abraham story. And whether that means it has to go be Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or just Abraham. Because it says he'll be the father of many nations. Now, what does that mean? You know what I mean? So let me know when you get that figured out. I'll be glad in hearing. Very good. Get ready, Bora.
Well, I had a question. Miriam and I talked a little bit about it today, and she kind of had the same question, understanding. It's on the Gentile and the Neshama. And, you know, in our prayers, my God, the soul you give me pure.
Yes.
So.
You've given me is pure.
But there, right. Whether we were born a Jew or whether we converted. So.
If you convert, it's easy enough. If you convert, you receive the Yehuda, the Nefesh Yehudi, Jewish soul.
Okay.
Said, done, and over with. And then, you're Jewish.
Okay, right. But so people have... Okay, so do Gentiles have the same five levels of the soul? They don't, right?
They don't. They don't have five levels of the soul in the same level that we do. They may not even go beyond... They may not even go beyond Nefesh.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know.
Okay,
to reconcile it in my mind.
Or they go to the level of the Ruach, but not on the level that Ruach elevates.
Right.
Because it really takes the Neshama and the Ruach to elevate a soul. Okay, because the Neshama is the one that receives the divine light. The Ruach doesn't really receive the divine light, but it gets excited when the Neshama does, the upper portion. So I don't think that necessarily they have the soul like that. So they say an animal has a soul.
Right.
He has a nephesh.
I was trying to figure out the difference, and you know, the animals. I know the difference in the animal and a person is a speaking soul.
Right.
But if they only have that and they don't have any of the other levels, it makes more sense to me.
But if they receive the Nefesh Yehudi, then they have everything that we have, everything that every Jew has. And according to a couple of the rabbis that have talked about this idea of conversion in the Gentile and all that, it tells us that in the Path of the Righteous Gentile, it's a book. Tells us in the Path of the Righteous Gentile that the soul of the Gentile who has converted is on the same level as the high priest of Israel in his day, which would have been Aaron.
I think I remember Rabbi Haggai saying that because he said, you made a choice.
Yeah, we made a choice, and that makes a bigger difference that, you know, You know, one time when I was, you know, just starting to study Judaism, had this one young man involved that was a Jew, and I wanted to talk with him. He said, why would you want to talk with me? He said, you don't want to do all of this stuff. He said, we have to do this stuff. And I said, I want to do that stuff. And he told me I was crazy. He didn't want to do the stuff. I wanted to do the stuff.
Yeah.
And you're crazy.
Okay. Well, Todah, thanks for clarifying that for me.
That's the way I see it. That's the way I see it based on, you know, what we did, the discussion we just basically had, is that's the system. And, you know, however it really, really works, that God will have to answer that question. But I think that's how I see it.
Okay. So, okay, Todah.
And once they turn towards God, then that's the game changer.
Right.
And he said it in Acts. He said, look, they received the Spirit. He was talking about Cornelius. They received the Spirit. Why should we hold back the water? And we know what he was saying there. He's talking about immersion for the sake of conversion. Of course, Christianity wants to write that out, but I don't care. It doesn't bother me none.
So. Okay. Thank you so much.
Good? Okay, very good. Any other questions or comments? We could. I pray that everyone have a most wonderful Shabbat, and we'll see you, Lord willing, next week. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. Lalito.
I'm flying my cursor here. Here it comes.
the notes from last night's class?
They're on Torah Focus, but I will send them out.
Okay.
Just go to Torah Focus and the Romans thing, and you'll see the notes for the class.
So where I printed it last night for Adon Suriel, I can get it from there.
Okay, yes, if you did. Okay?